we've got, yeah, I kind of lost count. It's the latest episode of season three of Mentioned in Dispatches here with the Armchair Dragoons. And tonight we've got a special guest. We have Mo from Mo's Game Table joining us. Howdy, Mo. How are you?
Good. How you guys doing?
I think we're doing great. And our semi-regular, occasional, usual co-host, Chris, is back with us. Mirth, how you doing?
I am surprisingly sober.
Yes. So is that a good thing or a bad thing?
We are going to find out.
Yes. Yes. I think it's been the better part of 18 months or more since we've had a sober podcast with you. So we're breaking new ground here. Mo, you should be honored. Chris is sober for you.
That definitely is an honor. I don't know why. I don't know if I have to worry about that or not, but maybe be talking will get him hitting the bottle a little harder. We'll have to wait and see.
We'll have to see.
We don't have that much booze, so take it easy there.
So obviously folks are going to recognize Mo's Game Table. You've got the blog, you've got the YouTube channel. Where else do folks find Mo's Game Table floating around out there?
On YouTube, and also, as you said, on the blog, and Twitter is my primary social media. I'm on Facebook, too, but really just kind of occasionally. I really enjoy the interaction on Twitter the most. That's where I have the most conversations with everybody and get a lot of DMs and a lot of just back-and-forth conversation out in the open. You know, you and I have talked on there as well plenty of times, and I think when they increased the character count, it really opened up the conversational platform of Twitter quite a bit.
I think adding the ability to do the threaded conversation where you didn't have to like write something and then hit send and then immediately reply to, like, you could put an extended thread in there and it would automatically parse them all for you. I think that was very helpful as well.
Yeah, so. It definitely was. It really allows you to see a conversational flow on Twitter, and I'm glad they did that. It really helps a lot, because otherwise it kind of feels like the CSW forums.
Well, Chris is our resident Twitter whore, so he may have to be the subject matter expert on Twitter here. He's found all kinds of things.
I was just going to say, Mo also does have a standalone website, mosgametable.com.
Yep. Yeah. So. That's the blog, and then the Twitter on Facebook, and I have a Facebook page, and then YouTube, which still small, not really big, but most of the stuff I've been doing is just primarily unboxings, with which I kind of do things a little different than your standard, hey, here's the game, check it out. I try to do it more in a preview format, so give you a little bit of a background on the game as we're looking at it. So I think that helps people that are looking at the game and curious as to what it's about and whether it's for them to get a little more background, and they go, hey, you know, I think I'm going to get a hold of that game.
So I'm not sure there are any large YouTube wargaming channels out there, let's be honest. Like, the tabletop wargaming niche, I'm not sure is big enough that even if we consolidated all YouTube channels together for tabletop wargaming, that we would get a particularly large one at all. So
no, that's true.
Yeah. So where did you get the start on all of this? Was it the blog? Was it the YouTube channel? Was it just chatting with folks on Twitter? How did you end up with Mo's Game Table kind of as a thing, and how did you build it out?
Well, it really goes back. I was writing for another blog, Club Fantasy, years ago, and a couple of years, about 3 years now, I think it is, 3 or 4 years, I decided to go out and do my own thing rather than just writing for someone else's site, and was doing my own blog. I was doing a lot of Euros, and I kept war games kind of to myself rather than doing reviews on those. I just did Euros and party games and stuff. War games were my fun. You know, it was my safe space that I kept to myself. And then I said, you know, I'm going to start covering those more. And then I says, I think I'm just going to cover war games. I'm done with the other stuff. I still play them, but I'm not going to cover them as much as I do war games. And that's pretty much what I do now, is just all war games. And then I decided to start toying around with video a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago or so. And that's when that all started as a little experiment. It just continues to grow.
When you're doing your video stuff, is it all recorded stuff, or are you doing anything live?
We did a live chat at WBC last year when we had Dave Heath and Mark Herman and Uwe Eichert from Academy Games and me, Gimpy Gamer, and we had Alex and Grant from Players Aid. We just did like a live chat for like 2 hours, and it started off, you know, pretty fun, pretty, you know, straight up and down talk, and then, you know, the whiskey started flowing, and it was pretty good. But the best part about it is just give Mark Herman a mic, and he's going to tell you great stories.
Yeah, yeah, I would imagine so. Anybody who's been around the game business that long. Well, and I think I'm sure if I'm wrong on this, I'll get a Twitter message or an email from him correcting me. But I think David Heath got his start as back when he was like a teenager working with Victory Games when Mark was still running the place, didn't he?
You're correct. He did, and that's when he actually talks about that in the chat, how he got his start there, and that really got him into the business, and he's been in ever since. So he's very thankful for Mark for the opportunity, and there's a nice history there, and it just shows you how small the wargaming space really is.
Yeah, I'd watched part of the chat that you guys did sort of after the fact. I wasn't watching it live. I was watching it afterwards where I saw that David had shared it. And I just you guys went for a while, right?
So yeah, we did. We went a little too long, and that was because the whiskey was flowing, I think. It was really what it was. But the funny thing is it was kind of just off the cuff. We just said, hey, why don't we do a live chat? And we set up a phone, and we used the phone and a mic, and that was what it was. It was not at all planned, and that's why the quality is not the best, but it was a lot of fun. It was an opportunity to sit down with three great people and, you know, three fellow content creators as well, and have a really fun chat. And I think it's entertaining. That's for sure.
You've just described the ethos behind our podcast as well, right? As Chris has characterized it in the past, if somebody just hit record with a couple of wargamers hanging out at a bar, like this is what you would come up with. I like to think we're a little more structured than that, though not much. But
these things have a structure.
Yeah, well, I mean, we say hello and goodbye.
True, we do bookend it nicely.
Yeah, we've got an occasional intentional question or two in there somewhere, but we try not to be overly intentional about it all. So Mo, you were working with Club Fantasy. You made the break. You started kind of doing your own thing. And so how much of this were sort of connections that you had made back at Club Fantasy? How much of it were folks you knew before then? How much of it was folks that you've connected with since you've struck out on your own?
Well, I think it was a combination of all three, really. I had made a lot of connections while I was working with Club Fantasy, and then along the way, you know, just going to cons and meeting with people and building rapports, which is something I really think is important to have, is rapports with designers and publishers. Not just, hey, I'm going to, you know, pimp your latest game or something for you and do them a favor. It's more like, hey, we're here to all work together. This is a community. We want to see them succeed, because the better, you know, the more they sell, the more games that they can put out for us, the more fun we can have. So it's a two-way street. And, you know, there are some publishers and designers that may not have that same, you know, be as energetic about it. But in the wargame community, it's pretty strong. You know, designers and publishers are very much on board with content creators, and I'm really appreciative of that.
Yeah, we've, you know, there's only been one or two folks out there that we've really ever had any headaches with. And even then, it wasn't so much about review content. It was more about sort of convention support and the things we were doing at game conventions. By and large, I think you're right. The community is small enough and friendly enough with each other that for the most part, people want to help the industry grow. And the way you do that is by being nice to each other and not being jerks to each other.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's Chris. Right?
So, well, I'm definitely jerks to people.
Yeah. So, you know, Mo, obviously tons of games that you've played or at least unboxed. Chris, tons of games that you're using to build new walls in your house.
I know, these are load-bearing games.
Yeah. So, Chris, latest thing that you've unboxed and opened up and actually sort of intentionally fondled.
I've been intentionally fondling Holland 44 because on the Armchair Dragoons forums, the guys peer pressured me into buying the mounted maps for it.
Peer pressured you.
I have not played the game, but I do have the rules, and I have the game in front of me, so I've been answering rules questions that have been coming up on the forum.
Took a lot of arm twisting to get you involved, huh?
Well, you know, the game's sitting here right in front of me.
So, Mo, what's the
I'm hoping to actually play that soon. I've been trying to get together with some buddies to play the GMT at any cost, their Mets game, Mets 1870 game. I have that punched and ready to go, which for me is a miracle in and of itself. I've been trying to schedule times. We just have to keep rescheduling. So I'm actually hoping that sometime in the next few weeks we're going to play that.
Did you have you clipped the corners?
For Mets, I have. I haven't for Holland 44
yet. Okay. Just checking.
But punching and clipping the counters and getting it all sorted and into the trays, I mean, to me, that's as good as playing it at this point.
It's as close as you're going to get?
Sometimes it is.
Mo, you have to weigh in on the existential question of our times. Clipped corners or free-range corners?
I like that free range. I'm going to have to go in the clipped camp because I just think they look nicer and they stack better, and it just feels like it's part of the zen of punching the game and clipping it and sorting it. It just, you know, that I think we spend more time with a game setting it up, like I should say, not setting it up, but opening it up and punching it and sorting it and getting it ready to play, and then lovingly reading the rule book and saying, yeah, I can't wait to get this on the table. And then it goes on a shelf for about 2 or 3 years until we get to it. And so that's kind of
2 or 3 years, you play them best.
See, that's the thing, is if we do it like that, at least we're getting some sort of hands-on with the game, where we're getting a bit of a connection. We also, I think that's a good way to get a feel for the game and to see if you really are going to get it to the table faster, because sometimes you'll open it up and go, this is actually a pretty cool game, I'm going to play right now. And you'll push everything aside. But other times it'll, you know, like we were just saying, it'll sit there for 2-3 years, maybe longer in some cases. Depends on if the bourbon's in the way or not, right?
The
I never put the bourbon always is accessible. Do you have the 2.5 mil counter rounder, the 3 mil, all
two and
of
a
them?
Half. 2.5. I got both 2.5s. I have the non deluxe and the deluxe. The non deluxe never gets used. The deluxe gets used.
Oh, I love mine. I'm going to buy the others just to complete my set of counter rounders.
Which ones do you have? You have 2.5 as well, or you have the two?
Yeah, I have the deluxe 2.5, but I think I'm going to get the other one just to have them.
You're going to get the 2 and the 3?
Yeah, why not? Do you have a laminator for your charts?
Yeah.
Yeah, doesn't everybody?
The nerd quotient is high tonight.
Yeah,
so,
no, definitely have the – you have to have the thermal laminator, and then – what do you do with your lamination when it's done? You know, it's going to be a little too wide for the box, so you take your little paper trimmer and you slide that down, you cut off the edges, and then what do? You take your corner rounder and you round the edges of your now laminated sheet.
And then hope it all still fits in the box.
Oh, yeah, well, you got to check it first before you call it done and start clipping it, though. But
yeah,
it works good.
You got to use the rounder on the laminate. Those laminated corners are sharp.
Oh, yeah. It's like a self-defense weapon right there.
Yeah, you can use it on your opponent in the middle of the game.
So, do you go the extra step and laminate maps as well, knowing that you would not be able to fold them afterwards?
No.
No, you can't laminate the maps. That's wrong.
Yeah, no, it would definitely not work that well. I mean, you could get treated maps, and then you can, you know, treat it like it's a military map if you want to, and then write on it and stuff, but then you've just destroyed it. But,
yeah, you can't do that.
When you're right on top of it, you do that on top of your plexi.
Exactly. Plexi is the key. You got to have the plexi.
Oh, yeah.
I know some folks that that do actually get the maps laminated, and they store them flat. They have like one of those giant library sort of map stand things where they've got all the drawers to keep all the maps flat. Mm. And they keep them all flat in there, and they just pull out what they need to play with them as they go.
Isn't that what you want to get for your National Geographic maps?
One of these days, yes. Yes, I actually do. I've got a giant stack of Nat Geo maps that I've accumulated over the last 40-something years, many of which are, quite frankly, awesome maps. And one of these days, I want the no-kidding map table up here in the office that I can... I've never seen one with a flat top that I could actually use for war games. I don't need one for the war games up here because I do have a small dining room table up here in the office that I can leave a game set up on. I've only ever seen those map display cabinets with all the drawers underneath, with a slanted top for examining the maps. I wonder if I could even find one with a flat top that I could use for war game maps, but I suspect not. But yes, it has been, you know, some dudes want the giant rolling like 15 drawer toolbox in the garage with all the like the full mechanic shop worth of tools and the power strip inside the toolbox and everything. I want a giant, you know, map stand with all the pull out drawers to be able to store all my maps flat out here in my office.
So what's going to happen? Are you going to get that done first, or are you going to play all your games first?
You had to go there, huh?
He's got you there, Brad.
Yeah? Yeah, he did. Well, let's throw in this caveat. Are we talking the war games, or are we talking the role-playing stuff?
No, war games only.
Okay, because there's a non-zero chance I could get to the war games. There is no chance in hell I will get to all the role-playing stuff I got out here.
Yeah, no, I figured you probably wouldn't because I know you collect like a ton of those things compared to war games. But, you know, and at the same time, though, you could get, you know, an RPG. You can do like a quick one-off. You can do a couple of those in a day if you wanted to versus playing a war game.
You could. I'm not sure you have a true appreciation for how big the RPG library is out here.
It's that big, huh?
It would take a lot of one-offs. Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, I had a hiatus for a couple of years in college where I was doing a lot more RPGs than war games just because I had more RPG guys available than I did war games. And it was never that I didn't like the war games. I just wasn't buying a lot of war games because I was buying so much more RPG stuff because that's what I was playing more of at the time. I didn't purge my war game collection. I kept it all through there. I just didn't add to it. But the other thing is, quite frankly, I can store a crap ton more RPG stuff in the same amount of space that a war game box takes up. Like, a squad leader box is the equivalent of about, you know, two RPG hardcovers and a half a dozen modules in the space of a squad leader box. So you can fit a whole lot more role-playing stuff in the same amount of space that you need for a war game.
True.
You know, it's just sort of how it shakes out some. But yeah, the other thing that I think happens with my personal collection, like I don't, obviously everybody's got their own situation. I tend to not hang on to too many war games that I don't play or have a reasonable chance of playing. I tend to swap those around, sell them to buy others that I might actually play. In a few cases, I've just mailed some to friends of mine and said, here, have a war game. Just pay it forward sometime down the line. I would say that I'm far more a collector of role-playing stuff than I am a collector of war games. There's a handful of things in my collection that I've got for collectible reasons. But the majority of what I've got on the shelf for war gaming is stuff that's there to be played.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of those differences. And look, I know that's kind of weird because, Chris, take a quick scan of the room there. What's the percentage of stuff in the room that you've played?
That I've played?
That you've played.
In my field of vision?
Yeah.
Less than a percent.
as the percentage? Well, I don't have that much in my field of vision.
20,
yeah,
25?
Yeah, between 20 and 25%.
Yeah.
That I can see.
Yeah.
Now stand up and look over the immediate row of games that's around you and see beyond and how many of those games you've played.
I can see what's here in the dining room just fine. It's the stuff upstairs where it starts to get dicey.
Yeah.
I have stuff in boxes that I forget I own. See, now it's problematic for me to buy games now because I have to go and figure out if I own it already before I buy it.
Oh, yeah. So you don't keep track of them at all?
I do not have any kind of inventory. I probably should since I have so many now.
Well, BGG's got the inventory you can use.
Well, that's a good point. Oh, man.
But that requires having to log into BGG and put up with the people on BGG to do stuff.
Well, I'm not a big fan of that, but...
You can log in and you can get to your profile and you can, you know, kind of lurk and stuff like that. You don't have to interact.
I know, and I do go on there quite a bit because I actually... for every game, they always have some little extra thing that I want, some custom-made chart or something like that.
Sure, yeah. File sections are always great.
I do use VGG. Actually, you're right. I should use the inventory thing.
Yeah, I could do that for the tabletop game stuff. There's not a chance in hell I'm going through everything for RPG Geek and trying to get a full inventory on that.
Your RPG games.
Yeah, I'm not gonna spend 2 weeks of my life dealing with that. I'm not. but I might be convinced to go do the work.
I should say, do you play online or only in person for your RPGs?
I was really only doing stuff in person. I did one or two play by forum post things. Back in the late 90s, but it's primarily been an in-person thing, and I've been fortunate to have good role-playing communities around and good DMs around to be able to do stuff in person far more than I've ever had to online. Quite frankly, it's the same with war games. I've been fortunate that I've done very few war games online. The vast majority of the wargaming I've ever done in my life has always been face-to-face, where I've either had regular opponents available, or in some cases, you know, my dad is the one that got me into wargaming, so being able to sit down and play with him is always still a lot of fun. I've sung their praises many times, and we've recorded podcasts from the store. I'm lucky that I've got Gamer's Armory in my backyard here that... we head over to Scott's store, and you can always find somebody willing to play something over there. I'm fortunate that I don't end up having to do a ton of online gaming.
So. Well, that's good. That's good. I mean, with the hardest thing I think I'm having a problem with, I think everybody's had a problem with, is time. You know, it just seems like the more crap gets thrown on top of you to do in your life, and then you're like, hey, at the same time I'm trying to, you know, do content, at the same time I'm trying to play games just for fun, and it ends up in a really, really difficult thing to do, and what ends up suffering the most is personal games just to play for fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Chris, how often does your regular game group meet up there? You guys are once a month?
We're once a month, and there's usually, I can usually pick up two or three things in addition to that each month. So I'm fairly lucky, but I'm divorced, and, you know, if my kids aren't here, then I don't have a lot of other obligations other than work. So if someone on the fly says to me, hey, you want a game this weekend, 9 times out of 10 I can swing that. And I'm fortunate enough that there's a handful of guys around me in the immediate, you know, within a 40-minute drive at most, that someone always wants to play something. Like, I've got a game scheduled for Friday night with one of the guys from the group. I mean, the group met last Friday, and this is just going to be a bonus thing on top of that. So I average 3 to 4 games a month face-to-face. I mean, like, real, like, GMT-type stuff, that sort of thing, or minis games, even. I'm pretty lucky that way.
Wow, that's really good.
Yeah, it's especially, I mean, I'm in Portland, Maine, it's, you know, so it's not a huge geographic area. I mean, there's, in the greater Portland area, there's probably 60,000 people. But within that, we have a solid little group, and that's, like I said, that core group, I mean, within that group, there's probably 2 dozen people that float in and out, and, you know, there's always 6 or 8 of us that show up on a regular basis. That's once a month, and then, you know, I can pick up these other games, you know, 2 or 3 more of those pretty consistently. So I feel pretty good about that. I talked with a lot of other people who live in, you know, in bigger metropolitan areas, and they don't game as much as I do, as consistently as I do. So
yeah, that's awesome.
I was going to ask you, Mo, I mean, because I am lucky I get to game as much as I do as far as sit down face-to-face with people. How much do you use Vassal? Do you use it, or how often?
I'll kind of toy around with it solo, but I don't play it face-to-face as much as I really should. But the hard part for me is committing the time to play a game, and I'd actually prefer to play, if I'm going to play Vassal, I would prefer to play that face-to-face, you know, like in person, live, rather than doing a play-by-mail, because I think it's a lot more fun if you can interact, you know, just jump on a server and chat with each other like this, you know, voice, and play at the same time, because you have an instant, you know, if you have a rule question, you have an instant access to an answer from the other person, or you can bounce ideas off each other or whatever. And I'm not a competitive player when I play. I mean, I'll take it serious, but I don't care if I win or lose. I'm really there for the fun of it and to learn a new system. And I'm the type of person when I play games, I like to just push things around and see what they do. You know, I'll just like, hey, what does this do? Oh, that seems kind of broken, or this could be improved this way or something. I'm always toying with a game more than I am actually trying to study it until I find games that I really like and I start playing them more and more. Then I want to learn the game. And then when I'm into a game like that, then I'll take it a little more serious. I still won't be super competitive, like, you know, a competitive mindset, like being a jerk about it, but I'll just, you know, I'll be more trying to, you know, seriously study the game.
So when are you going to join our guys for Saturday Night Fights one of these nights?
Yeah, I have to jump in there one of these times. I know you guys are always doing some Napoleonics, aren't you?
It's not always Napoleonics. There's a fair amount of that, given that, you know, it's Cyrano that runs it, and he's sort of addicted to short Corsicans there. But they've done World War II tank warfare. They've done sort of Victorian Age of Gunpowder. They had a Zulus versus British that they did one time. They've done a handful of different Napoleonics, obviously. What they've done lately is they did a bunch of the games from the old SPI 30 Years War quad. And then this past weekend they did Wagram. So they went back to Napoleon, but it was one of the older SPI quads. But they spent, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks working their way through the SPI 30 Years War quads. Those games, they were playing two at a time each weekend. So they had four guys around the table paired off head to head there. And it, you know, even though only one person was sort of going at a time across two different games, it still moved pretty well. I was watching a lot of it. I work Saturday nights, so I can't play. I'm just watching the guys play. It never really seemed to hang or, you know, sort of stall out at all, even though they were playing two separate games at a time.
So how does that work exactly for those who aren't familiar with it?
So, funny you should ask. We actually, that's the most recent podcast we had recorded that will be dropping in a couple of days now that we, you know, from when we record this one. But they use Tabletop Simulator. It's, you can get it on Steam. If you wait for one of the Steam sales, you can pick it up anywhere from $5 to $10. And it really puts you in a room with a table that feels very 3D-ish. So it gives you that feeling of the physical components around you. You've got a table, you move around the table, you can pan and zoom and whatever. You've got your little corner of the table with your own reference charts, your dice, your markers, your dudes, your whatever. And you're moving stuff on and off the table. And so when it comes time that it's your turn to move, you pick up your pieces and move them around the map that everybody's watching together on the screen as you move them around. And when it's time to roll dice, the animated dice go flying across the screen and do stuff for you. It's, you know, and Jim is a quality and willing ringmaster for the whole thing, for making sure that people are staying within the rules and that, that he's answering questions as people have them, making sure everybody's got an issue with the tabletop simulator itself, that they keep it sorted out. So he does a good job as kind of the master of ceremonies there, as well as a regular participant. So you do need the tabletop simulator software, but that's the only software you need. All of the modules for the games themselves, because he is hosting the game, you're using his version of the module. You just log into the tabletop simulator and play.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I've got TTS. I've just never played around with it that much. I've actually played around with Vassal more than I played around with that, but I'll have to jump in there and check that out sometime for sure. It sounds like fun. The only tough part for me now is we're getting ready to start off hockey season, so I'll be busy with that for the next 6 or 8 months. So some of my Saturdays will be eaten up with that.
Playing or just watching?
Actually, I do color commentary on a broadcast for a local team. So,
oh, excellent.
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
That's a far better excuse for avoiding Saturday Night Fights than what I've got. I'm just slinging beer and checking in field rentals at an indoor soccer place. We do have a dedicated space in the forums for the Saturday Night Fights, specifically for organizing and asking questions about the games. So, folks, as you're listening, if you're interested in seeing what's going on with the Saturday Night Fights, we do post the YouTube videos to the front of to the front of our site, but those games are streaming on YouTube, so you can watch them live, you can chat with folks live, or you can go back and watch them after the fact. You just don't get to chat with the guys playing after the fact. And then you can hop in our forums and see where folks are discussing games that they've already played and organizing the ones that are coming up. So Mo, that's where you would find info about what to join in or sort of toss your well-knitted hat in the ring and say, hey, guys, I want to come play.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. And what kind of modern stuff do you play? I know you like to play modern, too.
So the only modern stuff they've done so far was using the What a Tanker rules for a couple of minis shootouts where each person had their own tank, basically. And it was it wasn't a true free-for-all. You know, it wasn't World of Tanks, right? But, you know, it's an actual minis game. But it was single tank. Now, that said, again, if you're wanting to do, you know, full the gap, you know, 85 kind of Cold War goes hot in Germany sort of stuff, you know, start a post in there. Hey, guys, anybody interested in doing this? And check to see if there's already a pre-built set of maps and graphics available on the tabletop simulator. And if not, you know, send up a flare and somebody will probably help gin one up. And then, you know, get your game on. So
that sounds cool. Yeah, one of the games that I did get. Well, go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say it's worth checking out one of the videos, one of the Saturday night games, because unlike you, I have TTS. I haven't used it, and I haven't played one of these Saturday night games yet. But just watching the video, TTS is surprisingly immersive. You know, as far as capturing a tabletop minis game, I mean, it's not the end all be all, but it's much more than what I was expecting it to be. I'll say that. It's actually pretty cool, even just to sit there and watch the video. Or watch them playing as it's streaming, and then you get to kibitz too on top of that, which is always enjoyable.
It's better than not having a minis game. So
yeah, but the whole thing. The feel of it is actually. It's fairly immersive for what it is. I was expecting it to be much more just gimmicky, honestly. But it's actually very cool. It's very cool to see it. Get a really good look at the table. You get a real good feel for the game as it's unfolding. So, I was much more impressed with it than I expected to be, honestly. And I've watched even though I haven't played in them, I've watched a number of the Saturday night games as they're going on. And you feel like you're sitting there watching a minis game, you know, like you would any other, like at an actual table.
Well, one of the minis games that I've got, because I don't have a lot of minis games right now currently, but one of the ones that I did get, just really because the models looked really cool, was Team Yankee. And I have any of you guys played that? Either of you guys played it?
You're talking the Gale Force 9 minis one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, because I've got the old GDW box one on the shelf next to me here. There were no minis in that box. I watched a couple of folks play like the 2-3 turn demo of some of the Team Yankee stuff at Origins one year, but I have not personally jumped on it. You know, like you were saying, the issue with being a content dude, where you don't always get to play stuff for fun, the challenge of being the guy that's, you know, sort of the ringmaster of our Origins program means there ain't a lot of time you get to sit down and play for fun. So
that's true. From what I saw of it, it looked like, you know, kind of your standard minis game, at least today's type of minis games. You're starting off like an 8x4 or 6x4 table. I think an 8x4 is what they recommend. But even then, I don't believe you're engaging further than like 32 inches. So you really do have to move the contact, which is fine. At least you have some room to maneuver. But in one of the videos I think I saw somewhere, there had like a charge thing or something. It's like, what tank is going to charge another tank? You know, it seemed kind of a little wonky, so I was just curious about it. But I still think the models are pretty cool. So if that game system isn't that fun for me, I can always use it for something else.
Yeah.
I will say the system itself I don't really think would be my cup of tea. I will say the miniatures themselves are absolutely gorgeous and worth owning just for that. And you can play whatever you want with them. So
Yeah, having been a tanker, I can tell you that not once did we ever train to ram another tank.
Nope.
Never happened.
The thing is, at that scale, you get that wonkiness because those are fairly large miniatures for the table space, especially for moderns. So I can see where you start to get into some of that little wonky stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only point. I mean, those are pretty big minis for the table space, especially with modern weapons and the ranges of modern weapons. You have to start compressing ranges and things like that. I played a lot of 28mm World War II, and we had so many arguments over like how far an 88 could actually shoot. Well, if you're playing on an 8-foot table, obviously you have to accommodate that. But you'd have guys be like, well, at this scale, that should be able to shoot out across the parking lot to the building over there, a tenth of a mile away. I'm like, okay, that's great, but the table's not going to reach that far. So.
Well, I think a lot of people have that same mentality because they, games like Battletech, for example, you got these giant robots that can move like 150 kph or whatever, and they should be able to hit you several clicks out, but you got to be like 6 hexes from somebody to hit them, and then you end up in that circle of death, and it's, I think a lot of the miniatures games kind of get into that melee type of thing where they draw all the models together rather than having, long distance engagements.
Yeah, everybody wants their minis games to look like the battle scene from Braveheart, regardless of whether or not that's actually relevant to the game being played. Yeah, it looks cool. To be fair, most movie directors want their battle scenes to look like all of the fights from Braveheart, regardless of whether or not the weaponry would support that.
Sure.
Which is pretty much every ground fight in every Star Wars movie ever. They do. It's, sort of replace the stormtroopers with kilts, and it's the big blam from the middle of Braveheart. The minis guys want to push lead into each other, and they don't end up playing it sort of reasonably realistic. Again, the tanks, you bore sight them at 1,200 meters, but you can hit at, 3,600 meters pretty accurately. And how big is that table? Even a 3x8 or 4x8 Team Yankee table in scale is what, maybe 2,000 meters across at scale?
Yeah. You're almost in battle sight range at that rate.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you just, at that point, you're duct taping bayonets to your gun tubes and going at it. It's just, again, it's the difference between sort of, playing the game and having fun versus trying to replicate something that's reasonable for what's going on in the real world. And if you're doing more of a street fight, more of urban warfare kind of stuff, then yeah, you can do that on a pretty tight table because you don't have the sight lines for the longer ranges anyway. So, okay.
No
problem. But if you're trying to, approximate the North German plane, 4x8 table ain't going to cut it.
You need something a little bigger. Definitely not the desert.
Chris, you guys have put together some pretty large tables for some of your minis games, haven't y'all?
Yeah, I mean, 4x8 is our standard game. We've done some bigger games that have been, 6x12, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I'm not talking convention time either, though. I'm talking like just weekend get-togethers. Y'all have had a couple of big ones.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm trying to be clear. These aren't convention games. These are like our regular games. Like, 4x8 is a standard monthly game. We, once two or three times, or 3 to 4 times a year, we do bigger, like, weekend-long games. That's when we can easily do, like, a 6x12 table. Or we've done it where we have one guy who owns an old farmhouse with multiple floors, so we'll have 3 or 4 games going, each one on its own floor, where they're linked scenarios, that sort of thing. We can do some bigger stuff for sure. And I've been lucky to be in some of these games.
Yeah.
We did a double-blind Coral Sea game a couple years ago, and we had basically, we were running the game on 2 different maps, 2 different setups, one for the Japanese, one for the Americans. And we had 2 GMs going back and forth. you know, we had a master plot, and then we had each one with their own setup, and it was fantastic. I mean, it was we ran that twice actually in a couple of months, and people had a blast.
Yeah, to be able to do that not at a convention is pretty special. That's pretty cool that you guys were able to pull that off.
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky enough to have a couple of guys with fairly large houses and accommodating spouses to pull this stuff off.
Yeah.
That's the biggest key right there.
The latter being more important than the former, actually.
Exactly.
Yeah, there you go. So
we're going to take over your house for the weekend to play a big game, and it's going to be like a dozen middle-aged white dudes here stumbling around.
And she might shock you all and say, hey, that looks kind of cool. Can I play? And they'd kick everybody's ass.
They definitely could. They don't even want to be involved at all. But if they did play, they probably would kick our asses.
So, Mo, I want to get back to Mo's game table a little bit here. Because I know as you know, a content dude, we've probably run into some of the same headaches over the years, and I'm just sort of curious, what's the worst blowback you ever got from a publisher along the way for something that you said about one of their games?
Well, I can actually say that, now I can actually say it was outside of the board game community. Back years ago, I used to write for a couple different websites, combatsim.com for computer games, and then there was you remember the old Extreme Network? Or the old Extreme, what was the heck was that thing? I forget what it was for, but there was that, M-Player. Do you remember M-Player?
The name is familiar, but I've never been much of a digital gamer, so it's...
Yeah, they had their own thing called the Extreme Network, XN. They had Extreme Strategy, Extreme this, Extreme that, okay. Blah, blah, blah. Well, I was one of the editors on that. I wrote reviews, and one of the games I wrote was NASCAR Revolution from Electronic Arts, and... I actually titled the review NASCAR Revolting because it was such a terrible game, at least in my opinion. And it was quickly, you know, I got an email and a phone call quickly after that saying, you cannot be saying that about that from this company because this company spends a lot of advertising dollars on our site, so we're not going to allow you to post that review. And then they got a hold of it, and I got, you know, kind of a little talking to from them as well. And I was just like, whatever, and that was the last game I ever got from them, which kind of soured me on, you know, some of the video game stuff because it's still very rampant in that market now, that type of review, because it's really ad-driven. So far, thankfully, board games are not like that. You may get some blowback or in the form of a publisher not wanting to send you a game again because they didn't like that you didn't write a good review, but I have not had that experience myself, which is a good thing. And I've heard some people talk about it, but it's hearsay, so I don't believe it. I actually need to see it to believe it.
I have some examples I could show you of publishers calling people or sort of leaning on sites to get reviews changed.
Well, I can say that I do know of one publisher that is not very giving to reviewers. Let's put it that way. If you're a content creator, you want to talk about our content, great, but we're not going to help you out. And it's like, no, that's really not a healthy attitude to have because it's a two-way street. You know, we're doing this, you know, on our own time, on our own dime. And if we're giving you free advertising and if we ask you, hey, I need some digital assets or something like that, hey, it doesn't, you know, we're not asking for anything for free other than images, you know, and if you choose to put us on a review list and send us games, that's great. If not, that's great too. But I know some publisher, at least one publisher, that has given a hard time to a fellow content creator over stuff like that. And I, you know, that kind of turns me off.
Yeah. The, I will say one of the best experiences I ever had with publishers in terms of being responsive, being supportive, helping you out with images or with getting you in touch with people, whatever. Back when Jeremy still worked at Fantasy Flight, I don't think he's there anymore, but when he was one of the editors, like at Fantasy Flight, they had like 10 dudes that were always jacks of all trades. That Jeremy was always playtesting something while he was editing something else, while he was helping out with media on something else. anytime I needed anything from Jeremy for anything going on with Fantasy Flight, back when they still had Tide of Iron there, this was probably 12, 13 years ago, Runebound, Warrior Knights, any of the big box games at all, if I had any questions for anything for Fantasy Flight, I could call Jeremy at the office, or I actually had his cell number for a while, I could text him, and I'd get an answer within like an hour. And usually whatever I was asking about was either already to me or on its way within like a half a day. It was amazing how responsive those guys were. And it was always just such a good feeling to know that they were being that supportive of the content folks.
Well, what does that do for you as a content creator? It motivates you to do more and have that really good, you know, warm, fuzzy feeling for them to want to cover their stuff.
Yeah, I was approached by somebody else at Fantasy Flight about being a contributor to one of their projects that they were working on for like designing a scenario or something. And I ended up having to turn it down because at the time, Scry magazine was still in print and I was still writing for Scry. And while some of the other places I wrote for wouldn't have had an issue, they're like, look, as long as you disclose that you've done stuff for them and you don't review your own work, like, we don't care. Disclose it so if people think you have a conflict of interest, they can draw their own conclusion. But there's no way we can completely segregate the two because the wargaming world's just not that big. Like, we'd rapidly run out of people that could write for us. But Scry Magazine did not have that same enlightened attitude. They're like, no, if you ever do any work for a company anywhere along the way, you are no longer able to review anything from them, whether you worked on it or not. And at the time, I was actually getting paid for writing reviews for Scry. So I'm like, I can't endanger the paycheck here. So I had to turn that one down. It was unfortunate, but at the time it was probably the right call because I needed the paycheck more than I needed the pub credit. But it was I had a great time working with the guys from Fantasy Flight. Whenever I had a question or an issue or anything at all that I needed from them, I could shoot them a note, shoot them a message, make a phone call, and I had answers pretty darn quick. I was really impressed with how responsive those guys were. And Fantasy Flight's a fairly big fish in the pond. Obviously bigger now since they got absorbed. But, you know, they never, regardless of how big or small you were as a content guy, they never made you feel beneath their notice. And that was always comforting, right? That was always a nice thing to be able to have. Somebody else that goes overboard in terms of supporting content creators, we both know well, we all know fairly well, and that's David over at Lock and Load.
David sort of
falls over himself supporting the content guys, and you know, we love him for it. but
yeah, he's great. And you know, Dan Versen, he's another great one. I mean, he just, like, if you say, hey, I'm curious about this game, he'll be like, what's your address? Here, let me just send you a copy. Next thing you know, is you're just getting games, you know, sent every time there's a game. It's like, wow, that's awesome. Thanks. You know, and he's a really great guy, and their support is fantastic as well. If you're missing something, they send it out. Same with Dave, you know, over Lock and Load. And that's how I got involved with Lock and Load, is because I was, you know, kind of covering some of their games. And then I started having a chat with David, and then I was talking about some of the other games, and he says, hey, you know, would you want to get involved helping out? And that's how I got started working with them.
Yeah, Dan has always been really good about supporting any of the events that we were doing. That, you know, if we send out sort of a bit of an email blast to some of the publishers that were not with us at the conventions saying, you know, hey, just curious if you got any extra games laying around that you don't mind throwing in the prize box that we're going to use for the participants at our games. You know, we'd love to have a couple extra things that we could use for some prizes, for some giveaways. You know, 4 days later, a giant box shows up from Dan with like $250 worth of games in it. I'm like, holy crap. Like, you know, and not like, you know, dented stuff that, you know, they can't sell or anything, like pristine shrink wrap copies of stuff. I'm like, wow.
he's really great.
And we have very happy game participants at the end of all that enjoy, you know, some nice games as prizes that they get options to play with there. What was your favorite game that you've ever reviewed? Kind of the best review that you ever put out that you really enjoyed working on, and by the time it was all done and you sort of put a bow on it, you kind of sat back and went, damn, that was good.
Well, that would be – that's a kind of a tough one, but I think I'd have to go back to the computer games for that because at the time – now, everyone takes it for granted. Shooters are taking for granted now, but back in the day, I remember going to E3 in 97 in Atlanta, and that was the first time I saw I had already had a rapport with Red Storm at that point, and I got a demo. I got to see a demo and actually play Rainbow Six, and I was just blown away. I was like, wow, this is awesome. Not only are you – you know, playing a shooter, but it's completely tactical because you're mapping out your entire team's movement through this facility that you're, you know, an embassy or whatever it is you're taking down, and you're giving go codes and everything, and it's, everything is just super, it felt real. It felt like you were part of a team and doing a big takedown. And that was super, super fun to be involved in. And then the other one was Steel Beasts, which now is on to like version 4, I think it is. Excuse me. I think it's 4 Pro or something like that. But when I first played that game, the first version of it, I was chatting with the designer, and we were having a good conversation on the phone, and I remember saying to him about, you know what you need to have in that as a commander's recon? When they pull in a position, your CO is going to get out, and he's going to walk the area and take a look and get a lay of land in front of him. He's like, that's a great idea, and I think they actually put that in the game.
It's cool when they actually, like, listen to you about the gameplay itself and not just, hey, I'm a reviewer, but, you know, hey, I've got a little bit of practical experience with this. That's kind of cool when they can fit that in, too.
Yeah, so. I mean, mine was not the M1. You were on the M1, right?
Yes. Yeah, I either Slicks or the A1s.
Yeah, I was on the old beast, the M60 A1.
Yeah. If you want to get really technical, I did have a little bit of time on a Sheridan also, but that was in the Op Force. They were Vizmodded Sheridans. It wasn't quite the same.
I wouldn't brag about having time on the Sheridan, Brad.
Huh?
Huh? I wouldn't brag about having time on the Sheridan.
Well, again, it wasn't a – I mean, it was the Sheridan chassis, but with all the Vizmod stuff on it to be a part of the Op 4, you know, it's not like we were pushing them out of the back of C-130s or something, right? I mean, we were – We were replicating T-72s.
I said a bus triple.
Yeah, but they were the upgraded Sheridans that got shipped out there when they closed down the tank battalion at Fort Bragg. So I had one of the few Sheridans that had thermal sights in it.
Oh wow, nice.
Yeah, yeah. Those were not common. But yeah, I was on A1s. And then when I joined the National Guard, the first unit I was in was just transitioning off of their M60s onto the old M1 IPs, the old 105s. And yeah, this is late 90s, and they were just getting their 105s.
wow.
Yes.
Oh, jeez.
And the Marine Corps got them faster than that.
Yes. Yes, they did. Pretty much. I honestly think there was a Boy Scout troop in Kansas that got them faster than we did. I was on the IPs there, and then when I was in South Carolina, we were on the A1s, and then up in Ohio, we were on the A1s, but we were in the process of the brigade there was transitioning to where the mech guys were being affiliated with a brigade out of Pennsylvania, and we were reconfiguring as an infantry brigade. So the armor force in Ohio still existed. It just belonged to a headquarters in a different state. And at that point, I was working in the intel world instead, so it was a little different. But yeah, I was on both A1s and the old IPs along the way. But it's all still M1s. And, you know, tank tactics don't change that significantly between the older M60s and the newer M1s and whatever's going to come after the M1s. The logistics requirements, absolutely different.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the performance capabilities are different, but it just allows you to execute your same tactics a little faster or across a little greater space. But the tactics themselves don't significantly change.
Yeah, well, you have the Sheridan in that gun missile system, dude.
Well, again, Viz modded Sheridans pretending to be T-72s. We weren't playing with the air quote missile systems on there. Like, we didn't even have the 152 millimeter tubes in place anymore. They had pulled those out and just put the giant PVC pipe in to make it look like a T-72 gun.
Surprisingly was more effective than
yeah. And
well,
you know,
it doesn't matter. It's all Miles gear anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Unlike everybody else, we weren't putting our laser tag gear.
PVC was still more effective.
Yeah. We weren't, you know, adding and subtracting our laser tag gear every time we went to the field. We kept it permanently bolted into place. So,
until the umpire who's running the scenario pulls out the God gun and says, "You're dead."
Yeah, which is fine. Like, I'm still not taking my Miles gear out of the tank breech.
Yeah.
Right? It's in there and it's bore sighted, and I know it's going to go where I'm pointing it. So, hey, Mo, did you ever war game a battle that you fought in?
No. Have you?
Well, yeah, because the original Warfighter series game was the Bayonet Games Warfighter series, not the DVG Warfighter series. The Bayonet Games Warfighter series that predated DVG by, you know, 4 or 5 years, the first game was Fort Irwin. I hexed out the Fort Irwin map and did the Op 4 versus U.S. Heavy Brigade. That was the first war game design that I had published. And
I guess if you're saying in that regard, we did when we did sand tables all the time. You know, yeah. So I guess we would kind of, you know, you'd debrief and you'd go over what it was you just did. And, you know, you'd literally break it down the way you did it and, hey, this is what you could have done better, that sort of thing.
Yeah. In this case, it was, you know, I actually worked out the combat factors, you know, or a reasonable assumption thereof. But, you know, the movement factors and everything. And you know, Hill 876 is the middle of the map. And off you go with your mixture of meeting engagements and hasty defenses and whatever else. But it's most of the regiment. And a U.S. Heavy Brigade with a light infantry company is what's in the counter mix in the game, and off you go fight your battle. So it was, I got it. It's laser tag wars. It's
yeah, I'm looking at it right here. The Warfighter 101. Yeah, movement to contact. Checking that out.
That's... I'm working on a game called Battle of Bar Mills. Which I will have myself participated in.
I was going to say, I'm not sure that I would take tactics recommendations from you, though, because you've got a fairly spotty record, don't you?
Well, either way, it's a meeting engagement.
That's it. Mo wins the podcast. I'm done.
So,
And I really should have drank more than that.
You'll know next time. Drink a little bit.
Yeah,
more.
The funny thing is, I'm taking it easy on you. I had no idea.
I'm still going sober too. I'm not even drinking anything tonight. It's a school night, so I have to. Next time, I'll have to break out the whiskey.
Next time, we'll try to record on a non-school night.
I'm much more slow with it when I'm sober.
So, Mo, what's next for Mo's Game Table? Do we have a major event coming up you're going to cover? Do we have some major new release you're waiting to land on the doorstep? Do we have some new media frontier you're off to conquer? What's up next for Mo's Game Table?
Well, I've got a bunch of more unboxings, no shock there, that are set to go. The next one coming out is Brian Train game, Knights of Fire, Battle for Budapest. That one's going to be coming out. And then next month in November, I'm hoping to possibly, you know, get some video coverage out there, but I'm going to San Diego Historical Games Convention, Harold Buchanan's convention.
Awesome.
And then 2 weeks after that is BGGCon. So there'll be, I'll be meeting with the Wargamers there, finally getting to a convention because work has just been kicking my ass all year. I haven't had a chance to really take much time off. So this will be it for, you know, the year. It'll be my 2 conventions, and then next year hopefully get back on track to a little bit more time off. And like the, you know, I need to get out of the WBC. David actually told me I have no choice. I have to go to WBC next year because I missed this year. So,
well, what a horrible thing. You have to go to WBC.
Well, the year before I went, it was great and I had a great time and was going to go this year. But, you know, just the way things were going with work and everything, it's just there was no way I could get the time. So, because you can't go to WBC for like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday. You got to go out there Sunday to Sunday. Yeah.
Yeah, You got to spend the week.
Yeah, absolutely.
Real life's a bitch.
Yes, it is.
So, wait, you mean to tell me Brian Train has an asymmetrical warfare in an urban environment game? Man, who saw that coming?
He's really pushing the envelope there. He's trying some new things out, it seems like. So I wonder how he's going to do with asymmetrical, you know, this counterinsurgency thing. I don't know if it's a kind of a, if it's going to be a whim for him, or is it something he's going to really follow up on?
Yes. This might just be some passing fad for him.
Exactly. No,
Winterfest is about as asymmetrical as you can get. So.
Oh, yeah.
Well, so is Brian.
Well, yes. Good point.
So the
actually did the other one, Maracas, that he had, that Virtualia, that district commander from Hollandsville. I just did an unboxing of that one, too.
You know, it's amazing that how much the community reacts, how many clicks you get, how many views you get of unboxings. Like, you would think that the reviews or, like, coverage of people actually playing, whether it's an AAR or, like, live coverage of something, of people playing the games, session reports, that would be something that people would be far more into. But it astounds me what the click counts are for unboxings. I wouldn't think it would be all that sexy, but people are all over them.
Well, so. I think part of the reason why is because, like I was saying before, is unboxings. I've seen a bunch of different unboxings. I've seen them where somebody will just open up the box and say, okay, here's all the components, and this looks like it's the map, and these are your counters, and all these dice feel nice. And it's like that's really – okay, great. It gives me a quick glimpse of what I'm paying for if I decide to buy it. But I try to do a little more preview format, so you get a little bit more information. And the funny thing is, I've had several people say to me, "Thanks for the great review." It's like, that's not a review. I didn't talk about how the game actually plays because I haven't played it yet. I'm literally opening it up and showing it to you. So.
Yeah, yeah. I think they're cool because we all. We're all suckers for component porn. You know what I mean? It looks cool and the visual, when you get good visuals for a war game, it really enhances the game and the gameplay. And we were even talking in the forums about the 40X series of games from GMT. The Holland 44 map is a work of art. Like, you could mount that hang it on your wall. It's awesome. So looking at things as they're coming out of the box, yeah, totally get why people would be into that. I just didn't expect them to be as into it as the click-through rates and everything show that they are.
If you said that, okay, here's an unboxing, you're going to get like 2,000 or 3,000 views on it, it's like, really?
Yeah.
No. But yeah, it happens, and it's not for every game, obviously, but people want to see it. And the coolest thing about doing that for me is when somebody messages me or posts on, the video or something, say, "Hey, thanks a lot. I've decided to buy this game because of this."
Yeah.
It's like, that's cool. Or on the other hand, I've had people say, "Yeah, that looks really cool, but man, that rule book looks too daunting for me. Thanks for saving me some money." It's like, okay, well,
that's a good point. That's a very good point. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I think there's a lot of people, and I can say this just from reading stuff on the forums, who just don't have a deep experience with this kind of war game. So that kind of information, like what you just said, that rule book looks kind of daunting to me. I think that's really valuable. I mean, I'm not that mark. I mean, Jesus, I buy every friggin' war game I get my hands on. I think you're providing an actual. I know what I'm like, but I think you're actually providing a legitimate service there, people who. They know the kind of game that they can play or want to play, and then they see something like, well, actually, that's a level that I'm just not going to do,
Sure, and then the other thing, too, is I'll also try to make sure that people will pay attention to the rulebook itself. Like, I'll go through the rulebook, and I'll be showing the rules. I'll say, okay, now your rulebook, it's a 34-page rulebook. When you get to setup and you actually get into the rules proper, it's page 8. So just throw out the other 8 pages or even page 12. Or, hey, look at how many pages on this, or half a page is a graphic illustration, an illustrated example of play. That's cutting down on the text that you have to digest, too. So,
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's an important. I think it's an important thing to see. I mean, honestly, I tend to buy based on, you know, I know a designer, this and that. But it's good to look at these things. I will say this: I've become very fussy about map quality, just because there are so many games with awesome maps. And when I get a game, I have a few games I bought recently, and they're very good games. But the maps are just not, you know, they're not what I'm accustomed to. And it's not to say that I don't like the game or I'm not going to play the game. It's just, you look at them, I'm like, ah, that's kind of muddy. That's not, you know. So if you can see that in a video and you can get a feel for it, I mean, that's a nice thing to have, you know, that's as opposed to just going in blind and picking something up.
It's true. And the other thing, too, is that kind of plays into a conversation you guys have had on the podcast before about the golden age of wargaming. We have so many quality games out right now. It's like, okay, well, this allows me to screen games and say, you know what, that sounds like a great game, but wow, that map is horrid. You know, we can actually start being a little pickier now because of the fact that there is such a plethora of games out there. We can start looking and being a little more picky. Say, oh, I don't like that map, or that rule book is kind of looks bad, or whatever. You know, you can start being a little more choosy because of that.
Yeah, I'd love to say I could buy them all, but I simply can't. And, you know, I do have to have, I don't know, I have to have some way to separate out what I really want to buy as opposed to, you know, what I might want to take a pass on. So,
sure.
And, you know, it's not that I'm going to go just off of an unboxing video. I mean, I tend to read a lot of it before I buy it anyway. But it is nice to get, just to have a look at the game. And like you said, opening up the rule book and seeing that and seeing how it's laid out. I mean, to me, that's a huge step up for me. I mean, just to have that available, and that informs my. It may or may not make a sale, make or break a sale for me. But just to have that, you know, level of information, I welcome it.
Yeah, that's the format I just kind of decided to go with, and I just kind of keep refining it a little bit more and more as I move along.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, guys, we're around our hour mark, and although we do have Adam in our forum saying, you know, run these as long as you want. You're not taxing the audience. We can always pause and come back to it. At some point, we're sort of taxing ourselves because, like, I got to get up at 5 in the morning to get my son out to school. So,
Yeah. I have one more question for Mo before we let him go.
Uh-oh.
A great guest. Mo, what's the story behind your Jane Cobb hat? How'd you acquire it? How long have you had it?
Oh, I've had that for several years now. I you know, love Firefly, obviously, like I think a lot of people do. And the Jane character is just such a great character. And the hat is so iconic that when they initially came out with a really kind of a cruddy version of it about 6 years ago or something like that. And I got it, and it was one size fits all. So it was too big and it was kind of goofy looking, but I liked it. And then I found a person that is actually knitting them. And it fits much better. And I was like, ooh, I'm getting that one. And I got it. And the funny thing is when I go to a con or something, I have the hat on. Everyone's like, hey, Mo. I take it off. And no one knows who I am. So it's like awesome stealth mode.
That's a good thing to have. I mean, I will say that the hat definitely is part of your, you know, wargaming persona.
Yeah, you have to have a hook. And, you know, that's the thing that will definitely get everybody's attention for sure.
And, dude, you rock the hat. It looks good on you, so...
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's rather cunning, don't you think?
Yes. Absolutely. Damn, you really did win the podcast. You can be on every week now.
Well, I'm not sure how we're going to top that. So at this point, I think we're saying our good nights. I mean, good night to us. Good day to whenever you happen to be listening. Mo, thank you very much for taking the time to join us, especially on a school night.
Definitely.
We do appreciate it. And Chris, I don't know if we should thank you for being sober on this or not.
I'm not sure. This is what it's like to remember the end of a podcast.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, thanks for having me on, guys. I had a great time, and look forward to doing it again sometime.
Absolutely. We'll see about booking in for season 4, and maybe we make these some regular visits. In the meantime, if you are interested in the Saturday Night Fights, as Mo seems to be, swing by our forums. Like I said, we've set up a dedicated area on the forums just for organizing those Saturday Night Fights games so that you can find them a little easier instead of having to sort of look through a variety of the different wargaming threads. Not that you should ignore the Wargaming threads, but if you're looking for Saturday Night Fight stuff in particular, trying to make it a little easier to find. So stop over at armchairdragoons.com and take a gander through the forums and see what you think. And we look forward to you joining us there. And if not, joining us on the podcast next week. Thanks, Mo. Thanks, Chris. Thanks, listeners. And we'll talk to you next time.